Good afternoon. Jesus said, "Watch with me." That was all he asked of his disciples in between two terrible, conflicting events. The adulation of the crowd, the multitude hailing him as king on Palm Sunday afternoon, and then only 5 days later screaming for his death. In the midst of that, there comes a moment of total agonizing solitude in a garden called Gethsemane. And for a moment, in the midst of wildly swirling drama, Jesus feels so completely alone that he asks his three closest friends, humanly speaking, Peter, James, John, "Watch with me." And of course they fall asleep. It's a curious thing, isn't it, the way that most folks have a built-in need for others to take notice of them. I remember when my kids were growing up, we'd take them to a neighborhood park and down that crazy slide they'd go time after time, and every single time they'd yell out, "Daddy, watch me." I remember teaching my son how to swim, and he resisted it like you would have thought he was going to his death, screaming in such a way that I'm sure the neighbors thought I was filleting him, until finally one day he got the hang of it, and from then on it was, "Daddy, watch me." It's not just children who need that kind of recognition. Psychologists are pretty much in agreement that one of our basic needs, some have said one of our seven basic needs of all human beings, is recognition. I don't think you've ever heard of anybody breaking a track record without an audience present. They play better when people are watching. It's a proven fact that most people are much more concerned about getting a raise for what it says about the work they're doing than for simple increased buying power. We need recognition. We need to be noticed. We need to have people watch us. And strangely enough, it's not just that we need people's applause when we're doing well. We also need them to be there in our times of loneliness and anguish and crushing defeat. A loved one dies, and we don't want to be alone very long. We need people to be there, not necessarily to say anything. In fact, it's usually better if they don't, but we need them to be there. I couldn't understand that as a youngster, why people would all go to the home of the bereaved and what seemed to me to throw a party. But we need people to be there. And perhaps the strangest thing of all is when the condemned man faces the firing squad or the electric chair, he doesn't want to be alone. He wants people to watch. "Watch with me," he says. And so I begin this series of meditations by asking us to just notice the pathos in Jesus' voice as he makes that request. Do you see the vulnerability that he exposes? "I need you," he's saying. Three times he asks the Father, "If it be possible, please let this cup pass from me." And three times he's denied. Three times he asks his friends, "Won't you please just watch with me?" And three times they fall asleep. A lot of people completely misunderstand what was happening in the garden that evening. They say Jesus doubted. He lost his faith. He lost his confidence in the Father. He tried to get out from under what he knew to be God's will. "If it be possible, let this pass." I submit to you that exactly the opposite was the case. Jesus didn't try to avoid the will of the Father. He purposed to embrace it. Three times he said, "Not my will, but yours." And it wasn't that he shrank from the agony of the cross per se, although that had to be unimaginably horrible. But he had been predicting that in some detail for 3 years. He knew that that was what awaited him in Jerusalem, and he set his face toward it. He never once wavered, and he said, No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord. What was it that he wanted to avoid? What did he ask? If it be possible, let this pass. The contradiction of being in the very center of God's will and alienated from him. That's a contradiction, isn't it? He who from before the foundation of the world was perfectly, totally one with the Father was about to be separated from him. He who, while he was here on earth, never knew one single moment of disharmony with God was about to plunge into that place of God-forsakenness that is the result of sin. It belongs to you and me, not to him. I submit to you that it's not that he wanted to separate himself from the will of God. It's that the will of God meant separation from the Father. And that's what he wanted to avoid. Father, I'm willing to do whatever you want me to do, only if there's any way I can do that without being separated from you. That's my will. But even that, I'm willing to give up. The Puritans had a terrible question they used to ask people. Are you willing to go to hell for the glory of God? Jesus was. And for you and for me. Gethsemane literally means an oil press. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was crushed so the oil of the Holy Spirit might be released to anoint and empower all the rest of us. True story was reported a few years ago of a man named Griffin who operated a drawbridge on the Mississippi River. His job was to lower the bridge when the trains came along and then to raise it when the tall ships needed to pass. And one day Mr. Griffin had his two small children with him and he took them down to see the way the hydraulics operated this tremendous bridge. And a phone call came through advising him that a passenger train was running ahead of schedule and he needed to lower the bridge. So he set his little son and daughter on a platform safely away from the rails and he said, "Don't you move." He had 5 minutes to get up the stairs and into the tower, and as he looked out, just as he was about to throw the switch, he saw that his little son had crawled into the machinery itself, where he would be crushed the moment the bridge came down. To get all the way down and pull his son out of that place of danger and get back up to the tower again to throw the switch would take 10 minutes, and already the train was in sight. He was caught in an incredible dilemma of either killing his own son or the people speeding along in the passenger train. Mr. Griffin threw the lever, lowered the bridge, crushed his son. As he stared out the window, tears streaming down his face, he saw men and women sitting in the restaurant car reading their newspapers and sipping coffee. And suddenly he began screaming, pounding on the glass window of the tower, "Don't you know I just killed my son for you?" They didn't know. They just sipped their coffee and read their newspapers. Watch with me. What the disciples failed to do on Maundy Thursday evening, we gather to do with millions throughout the world this Good Friday afternoon, to watch and listen and ponder as Jesus is crushed in the oil press of crucifixion for you and me.
The following is the meditation on the first word, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do."
Seven last words, they're called. Seven pithy utterances gasped out over a 6-hour period We celebrate the latter 3 hours, but Mark makes it clear Jesus hung on the cross for six. As life was dripping out of his body. They're so familiar, and yet they're inexhaustibly profound. And in a strange way, they seem to me to sum up the whole meaning of his life and ministry and his death and atonement. Let's just sketch the setting one more time. It's in the midst of the Passover meal, celebrating God's deliverance of ancient Israel from bondage and slavery, that Jesus identifies himself with the very elements of the meal. This is my body, this is my blood. As if to say, you cannot celebrate your deliverance from bondage without realizing that that deliverance involves me. And what the Passover foreshadowed 1,300 years ago, I'm about to fulfill on an infinitely deeper spiritual level. At which point, one of his best friends slips out into the darkness to betray him. The others follow Jesus into that garden, in which he's in such agony and prayer that he drips blood like sweat, and they all fall asleep. A band of soldiers led by the priests of the temple comes to arrest Jesus. Peter, thinking at last the battle is joined, attacks with his sword, cuts off the ear of one of the slaves, undoubtedly aiming for his neck. Should have stuck to fishing, Peter. Jesus heals the ear and says, "Put away your sword, there is not going to be a fight." And they all desert him. In the course of the next few hours, he stands four separate trials. Before Caiaphas, before Pilate, before Herod, and before Pilate again. There are no charges that will stand against him. Pilate tries to release him. The crowd demands Barabbas instead. Pilate scourges him, washes his hands, and turns him over to the crowd. And the Son of God is nailed to a cross. Scourged, beaten, mocked, betrayed, humiliated, abandoned, exhausted, probably naked, except for that terrible crown of thorns driven into his forehead and nails through his wrists and feet. And he speaks, "Father, forgive them." They don't know what they're doing. What did they think they were doing? What did Judas think he was doing? Judas was a zealot. He thought the problem was oppressive government and the solution was insurrection, only Jesus wouldn't lead a rebellion. I submit to you that on a human level, you can't understand Judas betraying Jesus simply for the 30 pieces of silver. That doesn't make any sense. He'd spent 3 years with him. That's too little for so great a betrayal. I submit to you that on a human level, Judas thought the time is now. If he would only make his move now, he'd have the crowds with him, but he won't make his move. What can I do? I've got it. I'll get them to make the first move and I'll force his hand. Judas thought he could manipulate Jesus to get him to lead a rebellion, an insurrection. Father, forgive him. He doesn't know what he's doing. What did Peter think he was doing? Peter was reserving judgment. From Caesarea Philippi right on to the very end of the story, he's been rejecting Jesus' successive pronouncements that he would be going to Jerusalem to suffer and die. From the first time that Jesus ever said it, Peter's response is, "God forbid, Lord." What a great phrase that is. God forbid, Lord. He's just called him. You are the Son of the living God. You are the Christ. But God forbid that you know what kind of a Christ you're going to be. God forbid that you know what you've come to do. Every time Jesus returns to that central theme, you read a little phrase in the Scriptures, but their minds were darkened, and they didn't understand the saying. Every time He explained, I've come to die. That's not an accident that cut Him off in the flower of a brilliant career. That's the point of His coming. I've come to die. And every time He said it, they didn't understand. And Peter epitomizes that for us. Peter's the one who puts the words out that all of them are feeling. On the evening before the betrayal, Jesus had said it one more time. And then He added, all of you are going to desert Me. And Peter says, not Me, Lord. I'll be there. Even if they all desert You, I'll go with You to the death. Do you see that he meant what he said? When the little band of soldiers comes and he draws that sword, he's putting his life on the line. He meant what he said. I'll go with you to the death. So long as, when push comes to shove, you'll fight. I'll be with you if you'll fight. But when Jesus says it one more time, put away your sword, Peter, there is not going to be a fight, he denies that he even knows him. Peter was standing for Jesus, only it was a Jesus of his own imagination. Father, forgive him. He doesn't know what he's doing. What did the other disciples think they were doing? Well, they were protecting their own skins by abandoning Jesus, because if somebody identifies me as one of his, I might get the same thing he's getting, and so I'll run off into the darkness. Mark alone tells the little detail of a young man who they apprehended, and they said, you're with him, and he tore out of his clothes and ran away naked rather than being identified with Jesus. And scholars have suggested that had to be Mark's way of describing himself. Who else would know about it? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. What did the priests think they were doing? Well, they were protecting their privileged status, but more than that, they were protecting orthodoxy. Be careful of the religious. When they've worked out a position and invested their lives in defending it, they'd sometimes rather destroy the Son of God than admit they might be wrong. What did the government think that it was doing? Well, it thought it could maintain control by ignoring justice. Pilate, you see, failed to render unto Caesar what he owed Caesar, which was a fair trial and a just verdict, and in the process he failed to render unto God what he owed God. Father, forgive them. And I have to ask, do you find yourself anywhere in that story? Do I find myself anywhere in that story? Have we ever tried to manipulate Jesus to get him to do what we want, to force his hand? Have we ever tried to stand up for him, but only to discover that it was a Jesus of our own imagining? Ever found yourself defecting when things get rough? Ever found yourself clinging to an established religious conviction in spite of evidence to the contrary? Ever found yourself making peace with the world by ignoring justice? The verb is in the imperfect tense, which means it's best translated, Jesus kept on saying, forgive them, forgive them. Forgive them. Forgive them. Forgive us.